This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Hollywood has already launched their summer movie season ever since Jaws, or was it Star Wars? Summer cinema has been characterized by big special effects films, and this summer is no exception. Star Trek Into Darkness has been on screens for weeks. The newest Superman film, Man of Steel, opens in town this week, I believe. And the movie filmed in North Carolina, Iron Man 3, is already wowing audiences. We'll be talking about those and other summer movie treats this hour with two of Charlotte's leading film critics and one of the people responsible for making the impossible possible on screen. Matt Brunson is film editor for Creative Loafing. Good to see you again. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Also with us, Sean O'Connell. He's a film columnist and reviewer whose work appears regularly on Fandango, in the Washington Post, and locally on WCNC's Charlotte Today program. Nice to have you with us again.
One of my favorite shows.
Really?
Always. We always have such a good time.
Me too. But,
yeah.
But where's the popcorn? That's what I wanted. Both Matt and Sean are in our Spirit Square studio, and joining us by phone from Los Angeles is Eric Nash, a two-time Academy Award-nominated visual effects supervisor from Digital Domain. He's also an Emmy Award winner for his work in television, and he was Digital Domain's visual effects supervisor on Iron Man 3, and he got up very early in the morning in L.A. to be with us, so thank you for doing so. Eric, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
It seems that special effects, not just the big blow-em-up things or sci-fi special effects where monsters come parading in and spaceships land on Earth, other kinds of special effects, small special effects, seem to be ubiquitous. And the ones that are big are more spectacular than ever before. Is that my imagination, or is that, in fact, what's happening here, Eric?
Oh, no, that's definitely the case. And especially at this time of year with the summer tentpole movies from the major studios, the audience has come to expect spectacle, and we in the visual effects end of the business are, you know, responsible for bringing that spectacle to the big screen.
Is that what you guys as critics expect in the summertime?
I guess so.
And want? Is that what you want?
Well, we want good stories, first and foremost. If the effects move that story forward, or, you know, or because it's a story that's being told on an epic scale with the superhero movies that we're dealing with or some of the sci-fi sequels that we're dealing with, every time you get to a sequel, something like Star Trek Into Darkness or even Iron Man 3, the audience, I think, half expects you just to raise the bar, you know, to increase the scope of what's being told. And we are seeing that, definitely, especially with something like Man of Steel, which we'll get into. We were disappointed in it, but it's told on an epic scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what he says, the special effects usually have to assist the story, yeah. And or if they're going to make the movie stand on its own even more, they're going to have to like be cutting edge in some way, something we haven't seen before.
Eric, Sean mentioned that every time we see a new movie, particularly a sequel, audiences want you special effects folks to raise the bar. That has to put tremendous pressure on you, it seems to me. How far can we continue to raise the bar? There's only so much computing power in the world, it seems.
Well, it's true, and in the years I've been in this industry, one of the trends I've seen is that as the years have passed, what is possible just continues to expand, and what is quote unquote impossible has shrunken to not much.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we're always asked to push the envelope and do new things and show the audiences stuff that they haven't seen before. So, but that's part of the challenge and part of what those of us in this end of the business relish about this work is, you know, confronting new challenges and hopefully succeeding in doing so.
Do you or the company, your company, Digital Domain, specialize in certain types of special effects, or do you pretty much tackle any assignment that comes your way?
Most companies have certain things that they specialize in. At Digital Domain, we're one of the pioneers in doing photoreal humans, which for many years was sort of the holy grail in visual effects. And a couple of years ago, we won the Oscar for Benjamin Button, where we, you know, created a old Brad Pitt who you know, had to do everything a live actor had to do, and his performance was, you know, a virtual performance driven by Brad Pitt, but created in the computer. So that's one of the things Digital Domain is known for. The other thing is so-called world destruction. We did a lot of work on both of Roland Emmerich's big sort of end-of-the-world epics, Day After Tomorrow and 2012, where we destroyed various parts of the world. There are other big effects companies that do that, and from the trailers I've seen of Pacific Rim, it looks like other parts of the world are getting destroyed, and that was ILM up in the Bay Area doing that.
Mm-hmm. Eric, did you bail director Shane Black out of a problem when you guys lost your star on Iron Man 3? Did I read that about Digital Domain?
Actually, the company that bailed Marvel out on that was Weta.
Oh, okay.
We had a very aggressive post schedule to start with on Iron Man 3 with our early May release. And we were shooting, the original schedule took us shooting into September, I believe. So we basically had 6 months of post production, which on a movie that has, you know, well over 1,200 visual effects shots in it is a rather daunting schedule. And when Robert got hurt performing a stunt in the middle of the schedule and was unable to put any weight on his foot for, I think, about 6 weeks, what had been a very aggressive, very challenging post-production schedule became virtually impossible. Thankfully, Weta, the big New Zealand company that Peter Jackson started down in New Zealand, was just sort of tapering off on the first Hobbit movie, and they had a lot of bandwidth, a lot of manpower available, and Marvel contacted them, and they were able to step in and take a lot of the pressure off of us. Up to that point, Digital Domain was the primary visual effects vendor on Iron Man 3, and we, because of that six-week delay, it was going to be next to impossible for us to deliver the work at the quality that everybody expected. So Weta stepped in and really helped out there and did a fabulous job on the big third act.
I want to come back to one of your specialties at Digital Domain, and that is I've forgotten what you called it, but it's the creation of virtual humans, essentially. And you talked about Brad Pitt in the movie a couple of years ago, where you made him look Benjamin Button, where you made him look incredibly old.
Mm-hmm.
When you do things like that, are you? I don't know how to put this question. Does this challenge the actor involved because he's working with something he can't see and that doesn't really exist until post? Or are you building from a baseline performance? It doesn't matter what the actor does because you're going to fix it in post.
No, there are some actors who are really good at imagining what's going to be around them in the context of their performance. Somebody who immediately comes to mind is Will Smith, who we worked with on iRobot. And there was a lot of that movie shot on a green screen where we were ultimately going to add the environment as well as hundreds of robots that he was battling. And the director, Alex Proyas, you know, described to Will what was going to be around him, what he was going to be seeing, and Will, you know, got it, and his performance absolutely is convincing in terms of, you know, him reacting to what isn't there. Other actors' performances I've seen, who I won't name, are, you know, sometimes less effective at imagining that, and I know there are a lot of actors who despise working on green screen and not having that real setting and all.
But isn't that happening more and more, particularly in television, where they really can't have they don't have the time, and nor do they have the money to go to all these exotic locations. So they'll just fill in the blanks with green screens. I mean, in terms of setting, isn't that happening more and more?
Absolutely, and often on programs and movies where you wouldn't think of them as visual effects product, but in a lot of cases it's much more economical, as visual effects have gotten much cheaper and easier to do in terms of creating these virtual environments. It's a quicker and easier way to produce the film to just do it on a green screen stage. We did some work on Real Steel a couple years ago, and two of the big robot boxing scenes were set in big arenas, and we were shooting in Detroit, and there really weren't satisfactory arenas available, so we created them virtually and populated, you know, filled the seats virtually, and it was one of the things that allowed that movie to be made on time and on budget, whereas if we would have had to travel to two different arenas, rent those arenas, put extras in all those seats, it would have, you know, broken the budget.
Yeah, Matt.
I'm just amazed at how much green screen is used now. I was watching the gag reel on Date Night with Steve Carell and Tina Fey, and there's a scene where they're just sitting in a car with, you know, trees or street in the background. You would think that was filmed live, but on the gag reel, it was a green screen behind them. And I was just shocked. You know, here's just something you could basically just walk out of your house and do, and yet it was done with visual effects, which I found very interesting.
Well, I want to talk to the two of you, because you've seen a lot of movies. You're, as critics, you see everything. Does the increased sophistication of special effects and our demand for them and the need for Hollywood to do them that way, because obviously it's easier and it's cheaper and they can put their real dollars elsewhere, although I'm sure it's not cheap to do these special effects either, does it diminish the films that have come before? When you look back at a Jaws, when you look back at 2001, A Space Odyssey, or Star Wars, the original Star Wars, can you still enjoy them given the sophistication we have today in the movies?
Oh, yeah, sure. In fact, I probably appreciate them a little bit more because of the way that they had to work around physical problems. And Jaws is a perfect example of that. I mean, part of the reason that we love the mythology of that story is because of what a challenging shoot it was. Now, you can enjoy the film just as a standalone film without knowing any of that stuff just because it works so well as a movie. But yeah, I mean,
does it look as real today to us, to audiences who have seen these special effects that are astoundingly realistic?
Oh, some do and some don't.
Yeah.
We definitely went through an early period where they were figuring out special effects where they look chintzy.
Well, that's the same with CGI, though. Some of it looks real, some of it looks fake. Mm-hmm. And I think the older movies are enhanced, not diminished. I take great pleasure in like crowd scenes in old movies. I think it's fascinating that they get thousands, a cast of thousands to be running across a hill or something.
So when you watch Ben-Hur, those are real people.
That is amazing. Yeah. And now when I see a crowd scene, it's more like, you know, I know that it's just a bunch of like layers upon layers.
There are 10 people there and the rest
but
is...
But we have an audience now, though, that, and this is a perfect example. Like, I'm showing my boys the early Superman movies, from the Richard Donner ones, and they get to Superman 2, and there's a scene at Niagara Falls of a boy going over the falls, and it looks horrible. But I mean, at the time, it looked great, you know, but my kids are now, they're accustomed to seeing top-of-the-line special effects, and when they see these scenes of a man flying, they're like, oh, that looks so bad. I'm like, no, it didn't at the time, though. It looked great.
We're going to come back and talk more about special effects with Eric Nash, visual effects supervisor with Digital Domain, and on the movie Iron Man 3, which was filmed in North Carolina. And then we'll launch into our annual preview of the summer films with Sean O'Connell and Matt Brunson. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Ashe County Arts Council, hosting the Summer Gallery Crawl the second Friday of each month, downtown West Jefferson, featuring 17 galleries with diverse paintings, sculptures, and more. AsheCountyArts.org. Joe and Terry Graydon, they host the People's Pharmacy. You hear them every weekend here, and you have for years. In fact, they've been on the radio for 30 years, sharing home remedies and grandma's tips on how to avoid colds and whatnot. Some of these remedies, many of them, most of them actually work. And many of them, not even Joe and Terry Graydon, understand why or how they work. But they're in town tomorrow, and they'll be sharing grandma's wisdom about medicine with us at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, whistleblowers who expose crime, corruption, and abuse of power have protections under the law. What makes revealing top-secret information heroic or criminal?
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 until noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-supported 90.7 WFAE.
It's our annual summertime movie preview show with Matt Brunson, film editor of Creative Loafing here on Charlotte Talks, and Sean O'Connell, columnist and reviewer with Fandango and The Washington Post and WCNC-TV. And joining us for a special edition of this show, essentially this year, Eric Nash, visual effects supervisor on Iron Man 3 and lots of other films and television programs that you have known over the years. I have a question, Eric, about these new special effects that look so spectacular on the big screen. And then I watch them at home sometimes. I'll watch a movie on HBO or something that I've seen in the theaters. And the special effects that so wowed me in the theater don't look as real on television, even though I have a fairly big flat screen TV. Why?
I think part of that may be since we're getting away from movies being released on film, and most viewing in the U.S. now is done digitally, I think part of it is the difference between the color space that is presented in digital cinemas versus on HD TV.
What is that? What does that mean? The color space.
It's pretty technical, but it's basically the range of colors and the gradations of the two different ways.
So when you have $100,000 video projector in a theater, you're going to get a better picture than I get on my $1,000 television, right?
You are, and everything about that image has been tweaked and finessed to look its absolute best in that form of presentation.
Okay.
And then there's a conversion process that happens to put it onto HD television. And that process is one that's fairly young, and it's done to varying degrees of success. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes there isn't the amount of care and finesse that really is required in making that conversion, and I think that contributes sometimes to visual effects, which are incredibly processed images. The amount of manipulation that goes into creating complex visual effects is pretty extreme, and the images really have to be treated with kid gloves in terms of their final presentation. And when a conversion is done with less than that meticulous care, I think the images can suffer when they're presented a different way. And I've seen the same thing, you know, watching movies on airplanes, which are sort of the worst possible case. And you would think that it would be a lowest common denominator factor. You know, your intuition says, well, you know, it all looks bad on an airplane TV. You would think that it would sort of smooth over any imperfections in the visual effects, and sometimes it does just the opposite.
Yeah.
And the material sticks out like a sore thumb.
I know there were a lot of considerations as to why Iron Man 3 with Robert Downey Jr. was shot in North Carolina. I'm sure a lot of it had to do with film incentives from the North Carolina Film Commission and maybe some scenic,
yep,
facilities considerations and cost considerations. But this film actually takes place, I think, along the coastline of Florida, and you've made the coastline of North Carolina look like the coastline of Florida and other things. Given what you can now do with special effects, does it really matter where you shoot any film these days? Can't you transform any place on Earth into any other place on Earth or elsewhere?
Given the time and money, absolutely. We can do all of that, and I think the sequence you're referring to was one of our biggest challenges on Iron Man 3, and it was the scene where the terrorists blow a hole in Air Force One, and a dozen or so people get sucked out, and Iron Man has to save them all from free fall. Very challenging sequence, and like you said, it was shot over the coast of North Carolina, and story-wise, had to look like South Florida. But that wasn't the only reason we had to basically change the environment for the entire sequence. Part of it was because we shot it as a real freefall sequence, and that was one of the things Chris Townsend, the Marvel visual effects supervisor, proposed early on, and thankfully the Marvel powers that be agreed that that was the way to do it. Because I've worked on fake freefall sequences in the past where it's done on wires or even in a vertical wind tunnel, and there's something about actual skydiving freefall photography that is next to impossible to replicate. Part of it is just how the camera moves, the high frequency camera shake from the helmet mounted cameras. But we had to, our sequence was shot over the course of 8 days from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. And in North Carolina, I'm sure you know, the weather changes quite dramatically constantly. So we had footage that varied from clear blue sky to complete overcast, you know, shot 7 a.m. with the sun low on the horizon, or, you know, middle of the day with the sun high, and we had to make it look like it was 2 minutes of continuous free fall.
Yes, and you added people to the scene that aren't in the scene. You took out the parachute packs on their backs digitally. You changed the airplane from a prop plane to a, I guess, is the Air Force One a 767 or a 747? You did a lot of alterations, and you altered what the coastline looks like. So how much of that barrel of monkey scenes is real? How much of it is real?
Well, all 95% of the people in the scene are real. That's what was photographed, and that was sort of our foundation that we retained. And obviously not shot on blue or green screen, so an incredible amount of meticulous frame-by-frame, what we call rotoscoping, where you basically outline the characters to be able to separate them from the background and change that background. You know, nothing technologically amazing, just a incredible amount of detailed edge work. And in free fall, with the hair and the fabric flapping in the 120-mile-an-hour wind, the edges aren't hard and clean edges. They're often very soft and transparent and changing frame after frame. So that was by far our biggest challenge.
Could that have been done 10 years ago?
It could have been done. I think one of the things that made it economically feasible is because of the global expansion of the visual effects industry, a lot of that meticulous edge work or the rotoscoping that was done was actually done overseas for us. There are places around the world that specialize in some of that very meticulous, that very labor-intensive work that is done much more economically overseas. So I think all the technology existed to do it 10 years ago, but there wasn't the manpower available to do it as economically as you could today.
Eric Nash is a visual effects supervisor for Digital Domain, a company that specializes in movie special effects and television special effects. He worked on Iron Man 3. You've also worked on some really modern-day classics, Pirates of the Caribbean, iRobot, you've already referenced, Real Steel, Apollo 13, Titanic, The Avengers, just to name a few. And you also spent 8 seasons as the lead visual effects cameraman on one of my favorite all-time television shows, Star Trek The Next Generation, and Star Trek Deep Space Nine, for which you won a couple of Emmy Awards. How did you get into this line of work? How does somebody begin in this line of work?
Well, Well, it helps growing up in Southern California and having a best friend who was the stepson of Doug Trumbull, who is a icon in our industry. He's the man who was one of the visual effects supervisors on 2001. He did the effects for Close Encounters and the first Star Trek movie. So growing up in Santa Monica, I was exposed to this crazy business of visual effects, and it looked interesting. And I was always into photography from as early as I can remember. So it just sort of piqued my interest, and knowing Doug, led to a summer job back when I was in high school, and I just sort of went on from there.
Is there a difference, since you work in both television and film, is there a difference in creating special effects for TV than there is for film? Is it a different set of requirements, or just things evolve over time and you've been in the industry so long it's kind of blurred together for you?
Well, two big differences. One, the schedules for television are measured in days or weeks, whereas the schedules for features are months, sometimes years. And back when we were doing the Star Trek TV shows, there was a big difference in terms of resolution. Everything we did back in the Star Trek days was for standard definition television. Mm-hmm. Although I think Paramount is currently remastering The Next Generation in high definition, which when I heard they were doing that, it just blew me away, because they basically have to go back and reassemble all the visual effects work that we did and recomposite all those shots from the original film elements, because they were put together in standard def, and you can't really just up-res to high definition.
Right.
But that being said, today, with high definition, there's a lot less difference between television and TV. I'm sorry, television and movies. Feature films.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty close to the same amount of information on screen, although sort of in response to the improvement in television, feature films are now starting to see stuff at 4K. Chris Nolan, shoots a lot of his Batman movies.
That's the new super high definition, isn't it? 4K.
4K and shooting, large format film, IMAX, which was done on both the last two Batman movies as well as on the recent Star Trek film. So movies are having to up their game to keep some difference between high definition television and.
So where do you see all this going in your end of the business in the next 5 to 10 years? Do you see everything being shot on green screens? Do you see more reliance on special effects? Do you see the special effects getting bigger and better? Or have we pretty much maxed out what we want to see, what we can do? Where do you see it going?
Well, I think the filmmakers are always going to push the envelope in terms of what they endeavor to put on screen, and visual effects will, continue to meet that need. I think in terms of stuff being shot on green screen, I think that's a trend that's only going to continue as there are more and more facilities that can do that work. The cost pressures make it cheaper, so lower budget films can now have, substantial visual effects component. Unfortunately, from a moviegoer perspective, I see the studios making fewer and fewer movies, but the ones they do make are just these gargantuan visual effects spectacles. And I mean, they pay the rent and they keep us employed, but what I miss is movies like, one of the favorite projects of mine that I was lucky enough to work on was Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Not a visual effects film by any stretch of the imagination,
right,
but had a significant component and was a great movie and a really fun project to work on. And those kind of movies really now are going to the much smaller boutique visual effects shops because they, you know, have lower overhead and can the playing field is much more level and even than it was just 10 years ago. So I think those are some of the trends that I see. Okay.
Eric Nash, visual effects supervisor with Digital Domain and who worked on Iron Man 3 and all the pictures and more that I referenced earlier. I want to thank you for getting up so early in the morning and joining us from Los Angeles. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
We're going to move on to our summer movie preview with our traditional format where we talk about movies and play clips from films. And we'll begin with Iron Man 3. Robert Downey Jr. back as Tony Stark. And in this scene, he calls out a character called the Mandarin in the press for some good old-fashioned revenge.
Here's a little holiday greeting I've been wanting to send to the Mandarin. I just didn't know how to phrase it until now. My name is Tony Stark, and I'm not afraid of you. I know you're a coward, so I've decided that you just died, pal. I'm gonna come get the body. There's no politics here, it's just good old-fashioned revenge. There's no Pentagon, it's just you and me. And on the off chance you're a man, here's my home address. 10880 Malibu Point, 90265. I'll leave the door unlocked.
All right, now that Eric Nash has gone, what did you think of Iron Man 3?
It had a very tough act to follow in the Avengers, and this is by Marvel's blueprint. You know, they laid out all these standalone films for Thor and Captain America and Iron Man, and they got the whole band together for the Avengers, and now they're going back to the standalone films. And so I thought that the bar – we talk about the bar being raised very high – I thought the Avengers raised it very high for Marvel movies, and with Iron Man 3, it just settled back into its groove. It was fine as an Iron Man film, but it to me, it just wasn't as entertaining, or it wasn't as extravagant as something like the Avengers is, and it just couldn't be. It's a tough to live up to.
Yeah, and it's not just that the Avengers had, you know, 100,000 superheroes. It was also just – it was more well-directed, more entertaining, better story, and the battle scenes in the Avengers, I think – you know, I'm talking about the CGI bombast in a lot of these movies where the fight scenes just go on forever and they're not spatially, you know, done well where you can tell what's going on. And I think that's one of the problems that Iron Man 3 had.
But I'm so curious in terms of if Marvel just puts something out, because Iron Man 3 has made over $1 billion. It's become one of the mm-hmm. – it's in the top five highest grossing films of all time.
Already?
Internationally.
Already. Yes. How long has it been out? A month?
Yes, essentially. So I don't know if it's just that Marvel now is tapped into whatever they put out, people are going to show up for. And we'll find out in November they're going to do a Thor movie next. And we'll see if Thor does as well as this or if this is just positioned perfectly because it was the first movie of the summer.
We only have 30 seconds. But that barrel of monkey scenes that we talked about, free falling out of Air Force mm-hmm. One, they added, I think, two or three people to that. I wish I'd asked Eric this. Why add just three people when you got eight people falling out of an airplane for real? Do three more really matter?
Well, I think that it can look fake. You can see the seams. If they're all digital people, then I think the sequence wouldn't be as mind-blowing. It's a good sequence.
Okay, we have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about Superman in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Mecklenburg Stormwater Services announcing the new Water Watcher app, which allows users to take photos and report pollution in area lakes and streams. Info at stormwater.charmec.org. Whistleblowers who expose crime, corruption, and abuse of power have protections under the law. Understanding when revealing top secret information is an act of heroism or a crime. The topic of the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We're going to continue our conversation about summer movies, what you should see, what you should avoid, what's good, what's bad, what's ugly, in just a moment. Stay with us.
Like any other guy, I have that thing about De Niro, you know what I mean? Like, I secretly feel like if De Niro ever got to spend some time with me, that he'd really, you know, pretty soon it'd be like, you know, Robert De Niro and Colin Quinn starring in the Martin Scorsese production of, you know.
Tune in for more true stories told live next time on the Moth Radio Hour from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Hear more stories from The Moth Friday night starting at 9 at 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Sean O'Connell from Fandango and WCNC and Matt Brunson from Creative Loafing. We're doing our annual summertime blockbuster movie preview show. Another film that's said to be spectacular in terms of its visual effects is the reimagining and the restarting of the Superman franchise for the 21st century in Man of Steel.
You're the answer, son. You're the answer to Are We Alone in the Universe?
Can I just keep pretending I'm your son?
You are my son. And I have to believe that you were sent here for a reason. And even if it takes the rest of your life, you owe it to yourself to find out what that reason is.
How do you find someone who has spent a lifetime covering his tracks? For some, he was a guardian angel. For others, a ghost who never quite fit in.
You will give the people of Earth an ideal to strive towards. They will race behind you. They will stumble. They will fall. But in time, they will join you in the sun. In time, you will help them accomplish wonders.
You know you're old when Kevin Costner is playing Superman's stepfather and not Superman. You saw this film last night, so?
Well, considering the 1978 Superman's my favorite superhero movie.
Is that Christopher Reeve?
Yeah. I was so massively disappointed in that one. You know, the tagline for that one was You'll Believe a Man Can Fly because, like we were talking earlier, the special effects were cutting edge at the time. With this one, it's just the usual. There's nothing new visually about it. The CGI goes on forever. But worse than that, the movie is so serious, heavy-handed. There's no joy in it, no humor. It was a real letdown.
And do we need a new Superman movie?
Sure.
To tell the same story.
But we had one just a few years ago, Superman Returns, which wasn't great, but it was much better than this one.
Sean?
And you could – I mean, I would have argued, you know, a few years back, you could have asked, do we need another Batman movie? And I probably would have said, no, not necessarily, because that franchise ended on such a negative note. And then Christopher Nolan figured out how to reboot that franchise
but
and
of course,
make it interesting.
Of course, if you have a franchise like Superman or Batman and now these new Iron Man and Marvel Comics things, you do need to reboot them because you can't – you can't get away for some reason with bringing the old movie back to a theater. Even new generations who never saw the original, they won't go see it. Why not?
I'm not sure. Because they're made for different times. A lot of times in these superhero films, there are messages that were political and specific to that moment.
Okay.
You can't just take Richard Donner's 1978 one and put a polish on it. The pacing is completely off. We're a different audience now than we were back then.
But more people, I think, would still enjoy it than this one. I don't quite agree with that. I think because it's older, people are like, well, I'm not going to pay top dollar for an old movie that I can rent at home. And I'm not against remakes and such because, you know, you're right. There needs to be movies for a new generation to appreciate. I just wish they were done a heck of a lot better than this one.
Well, we need to keep emphasizing the fact that Man of Steel is really a disappointment because it's really a disappointment. It was probably my highest and most anticipated film of this summer, and it just falls. You're exactly right. It's too serious. It's way boring. It's all digital effects. There's no emotion to it.
Plus, considering what has happened to almost all the people who have played Superman, why would you put yourself in that position? We mentioned Star Trek Into Darkness a while ago, and both of you have seen the second installment of the series in which Chris Pine plays Kirk and Zachary Quinto plays Spock, who in this scene is trapped in a volcano while the Enterprise hovers above.
Spock!
I have activated the device, Captain. When the countdown is complete, the reaction should render the volcano inert.
Yeah, and that's going to render him inert.
Should we have use of the transporters?
Negative.
Not with these magnetic fields.
I need to beam Spock back to the ship. Give me one way to do it.
Maybe if we had a direct line of sight.
Hold on, Lee, man. You're talking about an active volcano, sir. If that thing erupts, I can't guarantee we can withstand the heat.
I don't know that we can maintain that kind of altitude.
Our shuttle was concealed by the ash cloud, but the Enterprise is too large. If utilized in a rescue effort, it would be revealed to the indigenous species.
Spock, nobody knows the rules better than you, but there has got to be an exception.
None. Such action violates the Prime Directive.
Shut up, Spock. We're trying to save you, damn it.
Doctor, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Spock, we're talking about your life!
The rule cannot be broken under any
circumstances. Spock!
Try to get him back online.
90 seconds to detonations.
Spock were here and I were there, what would he do?
He'd let you die.
Of course he doesn't, because he's Kirk, not Spock. I love Star Trek, so be gentle. How is this film?
Oh, I'll be gentle. I thought it was a great time at the movies. This is one where CGI, I think, works for the betterment of the story. It's just a fun movie, and it has the humor that, like we were saying, is missing from Man of Steel. So I definitely like this one.
It was. It felt like the first true summer popcorn blockbuster where you just went along for the ride, and it were great sequences, really good set pieces. The cast for this reassembled Star Trek is so good. You even just picked it up listening to their translations and their impressions of the old cast.
I can't think of the engineer's name at the moment.
Scotty.
Is dead on.
Yeah. It's played by Simon Pegg. And the guy playing Bones is great, too.
Oh, Carl Urban. Yeah,
Carl Urban. It's just a lot of fun. It's not the first one that J.J. Abrams did was better, but this is still a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's always great anticipation, at least for me, when Leonardo DiCaprio is in a film, because I think he's a great actor. Mm-hmm. And this summer he's in a remake of The Great Gatsby.
Is all this made entirely from your own imagination?
No. See, you were there all along. And every idea, every decision. If anything is not your liking, I'll change it.
It's perfect. From your perfect, irresistible imagination.
Now, from the previews of this film, and I don't know why I got this impression, but not from reading reviews, only from watching the previews, I got this sinking, sick feeling that this was not going to be good.
I think I did too. Also, I got a little bit scared that it was going to be very heavy-handed. It won me over in a big way. And it's busy and it's noisy at the onset, and then it gets to an emotional turn, and it hooked me at that point. And you mentioned because DiCaprio is so good, and I think he really sells the part, and I ended up really liking it a lot. So it's one of the best things. One of my favorite things I've seen this summer.
And I didn't. I was more mixed toward negative on it. It's like a complete surface interpretation of the book. Baz Luhrmann likes to have real showy movies, which usually I don't mind. But in this one,
Did he do Moulin Rouge?
He did.
And Romeo and Juliet with DiCaprio.
Years ago. It's a wonderful film. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this one has good actors. But, you know, I like Leonardo DiCaprio very much, but I don't think he has the stature for the role.
Okay.
I think every actress who's played Daisy Buchanan, it's a hard role to peg, and I don't think Carey Mulligan does it.
Right.
So it's a good movie to look at. But
how's Tobey Maguire?
No, Sam Waterston. He's basically Peter Parker being awed by
everything going on. That's not necessarily accurate. He's better than that. They do a framing device where he's essentially in a mental hospital reflecting on his time with Gatsby. And I thought that was an interesting way to get into the book.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
I like what they
so
did.
So overall, you
I liked it a lot.
You liked it a lot, and you were kind of mixed on it. And if you're mixed on it, is it Baz Luhrmann's fault?
I think a lot of it is, yes.
Okay. In After Earth, Will and Jaden Smith, that's Will Smith's son, crash land on their former home, planet Earth, 1,000 years after a cataclysmic event has forced humanity's escape. And here is how Hollywood is pushing the film.
We used to celebrate our planet once a year on Earth Day. But one day wasn't enough to save it. In 2071, we were forced to leave our world and find a new home. We never thought we'd return. Son, we are the first humans to set foot on this planet in over 1,000 years. Everything has evolved to kill humans. Remember, danger is real, but fear is a choice. If we are going to survive this, we fight together.
So, from what I have read about this film, it's already crashed and burned.
Quite so. I can imagine the pitch meeting, too. They were like, hey, let's take Will Smith, who's one of the most charismatic men in the movies, and let's make him really dull and colorless and dry and boring, and that's what they did. And let's hand the reins over to his kid, who, Karate Kid aside, just can't carry a movie like this.
And I can't argue with all of that you said, but for some reason it worked better for me, and maybe because I kind of envisioned it, like halfway through I kind of realized they're not aspiring to anything great. They just want to make what seems to be like a simple sci-fi story that you could bring a kid to.
Simple's right.
Yeah, which is fine because, I mean, there's an audience for it and there's, you know, young adult audience and maybe early teens who can go and watch Jaden Smith. And he definitely has a following because he has a music career and people saw him in The Karate Kid and they really liked him a lot. But if you're showing up looking for a Will Smith type Independence Day summer blockbuster, it's not that at all. I liked it more than the rest, but man, it's getting kicked around.
So we seem to have a fascination because this is just another in a series of end of the world movies where we try to save the world or the world's already been destroyed and we come back and see how it's been destroyed. And there's another film this summer. It's about the end of the world, called This is the End, with Seth Rogen and Owen Wilson and others of that ilk. talk to me. There was a Lawrence Topman reviewed this in the paper this morning in the Charlotte Observer. It was also in the New York Times. Larry liked it more than the New York Times, I think. But what do you guys think about This is the End?
I'm going to be the minority. I admit it has some huge laughs. When it's funny, it's very, very funny. But a lot of it has to do with how much you're willing to, you know, like each member of this boys' club. And for me, Danny McBride is just not that funny. And they give big chunks of the movie over to him. And when he's on screen, it really drags. The rest of the time, I had a good time.
The premise is that all these actors, including James DeFranco in this film, are playing themselves.
Yes,
and
right.
They're playing – and this is another thing that's going on in Hollywood a lot recently, that these actors appear in television shows and on Saturday Night Live skits and in movies now, playing themselves and over-exaggerated, over-egotized,
right.
Lavish lifestyle version of themselves. Why do they put themselves in such a dark light?
Because when they try it, when it's been tried in the past on Saturday Night Live or someplace like that, it usually gets a huge laugh. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what they figured out with This is the End. Whereas a lot of times that's just a cameo, you know, in a pre-existing movie. They sort of figured out if we stretch that cameo to the entire film and we play ourselves the whole time and we ruthlessly go after each other's careers and obvious mistakes. You know, there's a point where, like, they're trying to say, what does James Franco have in his house as they try and survive the apocalypse? And they say, what do you mean the Green Goblin doesn't have this kind of thing? You know, they're constantly throwing jabs at each other that way. And Matt's right. It goes on a little bit too long. But This is the End has the best ending of any film I've seen, at least this year and probably in years past. You'll go out on such a high that you'll think that it was a better movie than it was.
It's a good ending.
It's hysterical ending.
Really?
Really great. Really great. And
is this the end of this kind of movie?
It should be. Yeah, because they can't – there's no way you can do a sequel to this.
But, no, but there'll be more movies like this, you know. But it's been all downhill since being John Malkovich for me anyway, so what do I know?
That's another great example, though.
Yeah, but they knew to, categorize it. It's not just free-for-all with
this
everybody.
Being John Malkovich with a lot of weed.
Yes.
One of your favorite films, Matt, this summer so far is a film called Before Midnight with Ethan Hawke. This is the third in a series that I knew nothing about by director Richard Linklater, who started the series in 1995 with Before Sunrise, followed it in 2004 with Before Sunset, now Before Midnight, the same actors involved in all three projects. Why is this film so good?
I'm surprised you haven't heard of it. It's made more money than Lord of the Rings.
I don't get out much. I just do this program. That's all I do. That's my whole life.
Yeah, it's a little indie trilogy that it's interesting. It is the same director and two lead actors, and they all collaborate on the scripts. And it just follows the same characters over 9 years. The first one was set in Venice when they first meet, and then 9 years later they run into each other again in Paris. And then in this one, they're in Greece, and now they're together. And it's just – I think it's a wonderful movie. You get to see – especially in relation to the other two, you get to see how these characters have evolved.
They say it's so natural that it's like eavesdropping on a real conversation.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what's wonderful about it.
And you talk about what we spend so much time on special effects, and this is a no-effects movie. It's literally just two people and a camera pointing at
them. Isn't that refreshing?
Yes, seriously. Very much so.
And adult.
Well, and it's funny. It's a sequel. It's a legitimate franchise. Yeah. It has all of the makings of the things that we talk about, but it's performance.
Do you need to see the other two to enjoy the third?
Yes.
It helps. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Vin Diesel is back in Fast and Furious 6. It got 72% on Rotten Tomatoes, which means that's good.
Yes.
What's your take on this?
They are enjoyable. Yeah. They're cartoonish and overblown, but they right around the fifth movie of this franchise, they kind of figured out what they were, and they stopped trying to pretend to be anything but what they are. So they, it's like McDonald's. This is what we do. We think we do it better than anybody else, so come and eat garbage, but fun garbage. Fun garbage.
And it's amazing that the fifth and sixth movies of any franchise
right.
are the two best, because yes. by then every creativity is long gone, out the door. So I think they're not great movies, but like you said, they're fun, and it's good to see they're still at least trying.
Now, I know you haven't seen this film yet because it hasn't come out yet, The Lone Ranger, with Johnny Depp playing Tonto. I'm not sure who plays The Lone Ranger.
Armie Hammer.
Okay.
He's
overshadowed by Depp.
Exactly. Yeah. And although Depp, I'm sure, will give a genuinely interesting, different performance, there are people already saying that he set back a Native American image about 150 years with
right.
this.
Well, that's very possible. I saw the most recent trailer for this, and it was the first one that made me interested in it. It finally looks like it has a lot of big action set pieces involving trains and horses, and you're right, a lot of it seemed very stereotypical at first, but now at least it looks like that they've figured out how to make it into a roller coaster, which is what you want out of your July 4th.
I haven't seen the trailer, but July 4th and westerns in the past means Wild Wild West, so let's hope it's better than
goodness.
That.
So now, I only have 30 seconds, but we keep going back to Superman and Batman, The Lone Ranger now. What's next? Rin Tin Tin, Lassie? Is everything from the 50s and 40s? Are there no new stories out there?
No we're recycling everything constantly.
Father Knows Best, the movie.
There's another Oz movie this summer as well, isn't there?
I know it came out already, early. It's on DVD now.
It's about a week after it comes out. All right, that's all the time we have. I wish we had more time, but we don't. And that's Matt Brunson from Creative Loafing and Sean O'Connell from WCNC's Charlotte Today, Fandango, and The Washington Post.